Hey guys, before we jump into the show, just wanted to remind you one more time that the show I curated, which is opening at the Charlie James Gallery May 20th, is called Focus Group. Wanted to give you one more heads up about it for those of you in the Los Angeles area. Opening May 20th from 6 to 9-ish. I will be there from about 6:45 p.m. on and would love to see you there. It's an eclectic group of seven artists. I don't think you will see this range of work anywhere else, and yet it somehow all sticks together. So let's see how that works. More than anything, I look forward to seeing you there if you can make it. Thank you very much. Let's get on to the show. This is The Conversation. It's episode 190 with Clint Downing. He is the founder and owner of Downing Frames, which is in New York. It's a high-end, top-of-the-line framing business for the art world. They do a lot of art fairs, big gallery shows, and so on. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where, yes, you can go see images of not only Clint himself, but his team assembling in action, some of their fine framing work, including some James Casbier pieces, an installation in a client's home, an opening with work on the wall of theirs, and so on. It's all there. Go check it out. Yeah, this started out, I started out, rather clunkily. I somehow had recalled incorrectly from perhaps some random note from a potential guest that Clint was involved in a family business, that he had inherited the business or he had grown up in the business. I don't know where that random detail came from. Clint started the business in 2007 himself, as you will hear. So all that to say that I got off kind of on a rocky start. Once we got going, though, particularly when we landed upon Clint's interactions at clients' homes installing work, that got particularly interesting. So you will hear all of that, and you will indeed be intrigued. And the details of the business are quite interesting as well, the way that they reflect the current market state, the current art world, and so on. We're going to get into that in a moment. I just wanted to give you a heads up that a couple of things. One is we're at 190, so we're not far from 200. I've gotten a couple of suggestions, but I'm looking for a lot more suggestions for a special 200th episode. Very much counting on your ideas and feedback for that show. There have been a couple things that have thrown out. I don't know if they're going to pan out. So give me some more suggestions. And on the back end, I am going to check in with Louise Lawler, who has a retrospective at MoMA right now. So stay tuned for that on the back end. Without further ado, let's get to that conversation with Clint Downing. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you more on the back end. For some reason, I thought this was a family business.
No, I started this company in my bedroom in a cooperative apartment building across the street from Pratt Art School in Brooklyn.
Wow, okay. Let's go back there.
Yeah. 2007.
Oh wow! So that's not that long ago. Okay. And what was the genesis?
You know, I essentially decided to be a business owner while I was working at the most immediate employer that I, you know, before Downing Frames, and you know, like a lot of business owners or people who start businesses, I think. You know, in a lot of ways, I had worked up to a level that I don't think I could really get any higher in this industry, in this town. I mean, I could have done a lateral move to go to another highly distinguished frame shop, but I just didn't really want to do that, and I didn't want to change my circumstances. So, but yeah, like a lot of people that start businesses, I just kind of thought I could do it better, or I wanted to do it in my way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
where were you working before?
I was working at Baobab Frames. with Barry Fryer. I had started there as the woodshop manager and then kind of worked into the office and really started helping him working with the clients, doing some design, and then also kind of operations managing, you know, dealing with all the different departments, coordinating schedule, all that kind of, you know, day to day. And then by the time I was really comfortable with that, I knew I was pretty much ready to start my own company.
Got it. Okay. Do you work with artists directly, or is it only with galleries and like auction houses or what have you?
I think about 30%, 30 to 40% of all of my clients are artists.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's a lot.
Right.
There's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah. Well, talk about that. I mean, how much of that is them coming to you or you going to their studio? Or, I mean, obviously, as you had told me but when we talked last time, a very large portion of your particular work at this point is emailing, you know, sort of being the facilitator and the mediator. But I mean, maybe you could just, without getting into percentages, maybe you could just talk about some of the more on-the-ground elements of working with artists.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do so much more than framing. A lot of the day-to-day sort of framing, just kind of like get a piece of art into a protective housing that looks beautiful, right? That is sort of the normal construct of framing. But with so many of our artists, we actually sort of have a really good back and forth about the possibilities to sort of push the boundaries of what a frame can do in itself. And then also many times we are helping create the art inside of a frame as well.
Mm.
We work with a lot of photographers that are kind of exploring the boundaries between photography and sculpture. So a lot of the time we'll get photography here and then have meetings with artists about how that photography lives inside of the space of the frame, and then we help create the sculptures here.
Mm-hmm.
There's four photographers in particular that we do that with on a regular basis, which is really fun for us. It's been a really kind of an intense journey in adhesive material, in shapes, in the actual limitations of movement, and then discovering that movement and complementing it, and that's been really interesting. And we do that with Aaron Sheriff. We do that with Letha Wilson. We do that with even Ethan Greenbaum to an extent. We also do that with, I'm at a loss for words. There's so many.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a really good example of that. We also do a lot of different kind of plexi boxes or other sort of other designs that really just take a lot more discussion.
Right.
And it's about an artist coming to us with ideas and then really trying to explore them. Like there isn't really a place that we won't go, you know, like artists will come to us with essentially their vision for the project. And then our job is to tell them if that vision is compatible with the piece in terms of its safety and longevity over time. And then we kind of have fun with it. Then we fabricate really whatever it takes, whether that's sculptural elements, if it's just putting a frame around a piece, if there are pedestals involved with framing. We've done sculptural plexi boxes with frames on the outsides of them, lots of different photographic mounting, and really sort of blending a lot of the typical designs that you would see in a museum or a gallery. We've like fused a lot of them together in one package.
Mm-hmm.
And artists are really looking to explore new expression with framing, which has been really great.
It seems like when you have that degree of impact, you know, in an artist's product, that it would be, it seems like you would be able to demand a certain amount of cost for that. I mean, how does that work as far as how expensive, how much of an investment does an artist need to make for that kind of collaboration? Do they have to be high income artists to be able to afford it? Or are some of them maybe, did some of them get support through a grant or, you know, from their gallery or whatever to do that collaboration, you know, that kind of thing?
I mean, I have gone through many different ways to think about billing in terms of these projects, but what I've done to really simplify it is just break out the material cost and then do a per hour charge. So depending on what type of work we're doing, you know, depending on the expertise, there's different hourly rates for custom finishing, custom woodworking, or any other sort of, like if there's like more technical work that has to be done with their art, that's another kind of a charge. And then that kind of makes it easy on my end to sort of calculate. And then in terms of the investment in an art, what's really interesting about that is that, you know, artists, just like anyone else, I mean, artists really are business owners, right? Some of them look at their art as a business and some of them don't, right? So my costs are the same no matter what you put into it, right? You can get a $10 poster at a flea market, or you could have a $50 million Picasso, and my frame is the same price. So, you know, and in terms of collaboration with an artist, you know, some people really want to take the plunge. I know photographers, you know, in the mid-career zone that have really chosen the best materials that you can buy, in terms of anti-reflective glazing, really nice wood choices, and then with the fabrication, taken a loss or even broken even on the sales of their smaller works just because they want to set a standard for their own work to kind of break into the market, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some people really do sort of look at their art as a business and then they put an investment up front. Other artists are not able to do that, so they will get cheaper materials. And like you were saying, other artists are backed by larger galleries. And what's really interesting about that, where the financial burden lies, I don't really see an industry standard there. Artists and galleries really do seem to have their own setup. Like each relationship seems to have its own rules.
Mm-hmm.
From like historically from my side, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes they split it. Sometimes the, you know, the gallery will pay. Sometimes it's on the artist. And whether it comes out of sales or a percentage of sales, that also, I think, varies depending on the artist.
Right. I'm interested in that term you use, taking the plunge, because I could see how an artist who is not being backed, you know, one way or another, or does not have an advanced sale, if they're going to spend top dollar for, you know, the best you have to offer, and they're going to take a loss. I don't know if off the top of your head you can think about artists that have done that over the past and that's panned out for them or maybe has not panned out for them because, in other words, maybe there's a typical case where an artist would have been better served just going affordable and in order to continue to sort of build until they get to the point where they can afford to do it. And maybe others, you know, somehow it made the difference. Or is that too hard to see even?
I have seen that in the past, especially on the creative fabrication side, where artists will come here with ideas that sort of go past either their space or their skill set.
Mm-hmm.
Like we've done lots of different types of resin pours, really any kind of other fabrication where, if an artist doesn't have the right space or again, outside of their skills, that is a financial risk. And I have seen people, come to us for our services and have bodies of work that haven't really panned out. People figure out how to get through it. Mm-hmm. I've seen that with more kind of lower mid-career level artists where I thought it was definitely going to make an impact and it was for sure a financial burden. I think where I don't see it is where it's more of the entry-level artist who really does want to kind of explore high-end fabrication. And if it doesn't work out for them, I think I probably just don't see them again. You know, like they'll come in here with one order, and then they'll just find another option. Because right. There definitely is a point of diminishing returns, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's like for everybody with all materials or experience, right? I mean, if you're just not getting out of it what you want, you definitely make other choices.
Yeah. Right. I kind of feel like you and your team have mastered production as far as these things, even with newer materials. Like you mentioned the resin pour. I don't know if that's like one of your newer offerings, but all that to wonder what, if you've had some mishaps along the way. Because the situation was too rushed or you were trying out something new or what have you?
We have had thousands of mishaps. I mean, honestly, as far as I'm concerned, the only way to really know what you're doing is just to make mistakes, right? I mean, there just has to be this, innate sense to not be afraid to fail. And
right.
Then just learn from failure. I mean, that is just like the number one it's 50% of the guiding force of Downing Frames is to just not be afraid to fail and try new stuff and then communicate, right? I mean, we all just go into new projects, into new ventures, just kind of open wide. You know, I tend to not like promise miracles and then just, at least at first, and then really sort of respect the process. And then, of course, we are so rushed. This industry is very rushed. And that's fine. I think the reason Downing Frames has grown so fast is we are able to cope with the rushes. And it's definitely not easy. I know you mentioned that we've mastered production. I don't know that I'll ever do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's every time a product leaves Downing Frames, it meets Downing Frame standards. I mean, we strive to make the highest quality frames in this industry. But it can be tough, right? I mean, and it's ever-changing industry. This industry is moving over more towards the art fair model.
Yeah.
So especially in New York City where we had the Armory Show, and now we've added Freeze a few years ago, and now TFAF, and then the satellite fairs. So now there's APAD is getting much more popular, I think. With more added fairs and more popularity for those fairs, our sort of rush season is really is really changing a lot. So we're just always on our toes, and it's never production's never easy when you're just so busy all the time.
Right.
So I'm really working on efficiency, storage, talent, training, all of that is like always happening here.
But if you have if you've had all these mishaps, as you said, but you're getting things out the door so that they're to your satisfaction, then you're implying that there's a pretty big window that you allow yourself, whether it's, a big window relative to the project, or just generally, like, I don't know, a couple weeks or a month or whatever. The way that I'm reading between the lines, that if you're able to, go through failure to learn new options, new forms for your frames, but it's going out the door, 100% up to spec, then, am I right?
Well, the main thing is whenever we're coming into, especially a new process, or even some of the like newer, I think where the experience comes in is that I always have like a very planned out and fairly viable plan B.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's lots of different ways to get to the end. We're fairly malleable that way. And the nice thing is, too, is that I have 18 employees.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of people here.
Yeah.
So the nice thing is sometimes what I have to do just to get through the crunch is I have some people that are sort of flex between the wood shop and the upstairs fitting room, which sometimes I just transition people and then, allocate more resources into a department, if there's like a huge rush. So that's really nice too. I mean, I think part of it is just having so many talented people here.
So when you say you have 18 staff, how many of those are doing production? All of them? I mean, you have a woman who answered the phone, for example.
Myself?
I don't imagine she's doing production.
Yeah, it's myself and three other people here are doing the essentially kind of design and administrative stuff.
Okay.
So it is kind of a flexible staff of like 14 to 16 people doing the production, because I'll also do production. I'm also very hands-on with the staff.
Right. Are you a benevolent boss?
I think so.
Uh-huh. Do you ever yell at your employees?
I really do. It's very rare. I mean, it is very, very rare.
Uh-huh.
I just am not that kind of person, but I do put a lot of pressure on. There's no doubt about that. But I like everyone here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge part of it. I've surrounded myself with a lot of people that I really respect. Mm. So yelling just doesn't come out of that.
Well, what does it mean to put pressure on people? How does that work?
The other thing too is that the pressure is already sort of built into the need, right? It's like everyone here, a lot of the people here at the staff know the artist too. Like if there's like a sort of a technical issue or something that we need to explain, like I was saying before about some of the more sculptural photography stuff, my staff is really personally involved. Especially in the fitting room, that's where everything, where the crunch really happens.
Mm-hmm.
If we're behind.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're kind of involved in a little bit of higher level than I guess maybe your average worker at a business. So they also feel personally responsible, like to the artist. So in a way, I don't even you know, I just try to remind people just how important it is, right? Like if there's an install on a Tuesday, there's photography, there are VIP clients, you know, it's not just the artist, but the gallery is depending on this. I mean, people put an awful lot of money and effort into putting on an art show, and that does not, that's not lost on any of the people who work here.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, our deadlines are hard. There is no, there's really no wiggle room, because so much of our work is contemporary artwork that's going on gallery walls right now. So it's kind of baked into the cake. You know, when you work here, you just get it done.
Right. Yeah. Like we so are you available for somebody who wants to develop a reality show around high-end framing?
It would be riveting television. I mean, there is more here than anyone could ever imagine.
Okay. Right.
It's rich with all kinds of emotions and effort and, you know, and cool art. There's a lot here.
But I imagine, that said, though, that based on the way you described that you like everybody and, you know, everybody knows what they need to do, and sometimes they know the artist whose work they're framing, that people are not, you don't have too many drama queens running around in your business. I can't imagine that you would have one even, right?
I definitely do not. Drama queens do not last at Downing Frames.
Right. So, and speaking of which, the other thing that you made me think about is, as you were describing all the work you're doing, you know, to get these things perfect to get up on the wall at the gallery for the VIPs, is how do you feel personally, and then secondly, how does your staff feel about being the producers behind the scenes? You know, I mean, you may have glory in the satisfaction of fine craftsmanship, but you know what I mean? You see where I'm going with that question.
I love exactly where we're at. I feel honored to be in the position that I am, with the amazing clientele and the galleries that we have, the quality of the artwork, and I am perfectly happy being behind the scenes. The galleries that we work for and the artists that we work for know exactly what we do. And the relationships that I have there are enough to satisfy me for the rest of my life. I mean, there's so much there, you know, and there's a lot of gratitude. You know, for most of the galleries and the artists that we have, there's just so many thanks, you know, again, because we're in an industry that's in a lot of cases really last minute. You know, some galleries have to pivot, you know, to make certain choices. And there could be 100 different reasons why there's a rush. And it feels great to be able to do the impossible. And again, there's plenty of recognition in it for us.
Mm, okay. Well, I mean, there's a little bit of counterintuitivity there in that, and maybe I'm just being a little cynical, but I would think that in some cases, maybe these are not the clients that you work with at all, but in some cases, I would think that galleries and artists take things like framing for granted, you know, and do not show a particularly large amount of gratitude, you know, and I think people listening would not be surprised by that perception either. So are your clients then the exception that they have so much gratitude, or is it more just that the art world is much more of a professional and gratitude-sharing place than maybe I realize?
There's a couple of different reasons for that. I mean, without sounding, you know, I don't know how this is going to sound, but I, you know, there's a lot of bad framing. Right. I mean, there are other people that also make really great frames, but we hear an awful lot that, you know, our customer service is really great. You know, just sort of the attitude of this company, plus the high quality of work. Like, you know, when we deliver a job, it's not just that we get it done on time, but they can really tell the difference, right?
I mean, right.
We often get emails or cards in the mail that just say, you know, how just what a difference it is, that our product just stands out so much more. So I think it's kind of, you know, it's not necessarily that the art world is so thankful, because honestly, there's so much work to do at this level that I think people are even too busy for that sometimes. But I think our product really kind of stands out, honestly.
Right.
And I think that's why we get it. Because you know, for a lot of reasons, whether it's, you know, I think one thing too is so much of our stuff is last minute, and I don't think people expect to get high quality stuff last minute. You know, I think that's just also sort of like an understood thing. If you need it right now, it's probably not going to be that good.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of different things, but I really do. I think I'm not just saying it. We do get a lot of thanks, and I don't know how that pans out in the rest of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I feel really happy about that.
Right, right. That's great. I'm trying to decide where we should go next. Do you have any suggestions?
There's so much to talk about. I mean,
okay. Well, what's rising to most to the top, would you say?
Right now, I've been doing a lot of installs where we frame large artwork. You know, contemporary artwork is so large now.
Yeah.
And they'll buy it, and it'll get to their apartments, and it doesn't fit.
Oh, wow.
And so then there has to be like a complete rethought. Redesign, making frames in a totally different way to be mobile and built into people's houses and then installed. There is, I mean, again, so much of my life is like being, trying to get clear communication happening with my staff.
Right.
Trying to innovate this industry is kind of what I'm going to be trying to think about next. I'm not sure how I'm going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I can say too much about that.
Well, let's go back to the install for a second then. So
yeah,
are you actually then, you're going to these sites in some cases, and are you basically sort of doing the math as far as, all right, what do we need to do to redesign this frame or this apparatus to get it so it will make it through, or do we need to take it apart and then put it back together once it gets inside the home, or all of the above? What kind of situations are we talking about?
Sometimes it could be just as simple as taking the frame off, making that collapsible in some kind of way, and then having the art package sort of fit in. This past week we had a very large piece that just didn't make the elevator by half an inch. So
wow.
It was a very costly half an inch for my client. But in that case, what we did is we just scrapped the frame because sometimes I can take the frames apart and then just sort of shave the materials. But in this instance with this piece, I couldn't do that. So we just fabricated a brand new frame and didn't join it. So we finished it in its four sticks, and then used a biscuit system for joining. And then luckily we were able to get the piece into the house without taking it apart. And it was a good thing too, because it was a multi-panel piece of artwork consisting of 12 hinged pieces of paper. So, But then we get up there. You have to kind of figure out how you're going to work with the space, right? Everyone in the apartment is different. Everyone feels differently about their apartment and the stuff in it, right? So the first thing is just to kind of gauge the owner or who's ever there, you know, some sort of, you know, butlers in many cases, house, you know, house staff. We deal a lot with house staff. You know, so the first thing we do when we get into people's houses is just to navigate the emotional feel of the place. Right?
Now you're talking. You know, now you're talking, Clint. This is, you know, this, like, is my bread, you know, and butter. So, tell me about how the other side lives.
Oh, very very well. I mean, we deal with mostly high net worth individuals, and I gotta say, I really enjoy being in a lot of these places. You know, it's very rare that I have any sort of negative experience. You know, I get to experience a lot of cutting edge design. Mm. I see some of the most beautiful furniture in the world. Mm-hmm. Amazing light fixtures. I mean, you know, there's a lot of really nice stuff.
Yeah.
And then honestly, mostly really nice people.
Well, are these the staff, though, that you're mostly interacting with, or are you dealing with the owners themselves, or both?
Usually both. Typically what happens is, especially up front, right? A lot of these people are not going to let you into their house without knowing you, even with their staff. You know, they will at least hang out for a half an hour. You know, usually there's some sort of, like, you know, sort of like kind of formal but fairly relaxed sort of introduction, a little bit of banter to kind of, you know, break the ice, and then they'll just kind of hang out just to make sure you're not going to burn the house down.
Wow.
and then they'll, you know, of course, get back to their day doing whatever they're doing, and then I'll deal with, you know, whoever runs the house. But typically there is an upfront meeting for at least some of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or they'll come in halfway through the job, but I almost always see one of the owners of the house, if it's a married couple or, you know, some kind of partnership. I mean, I'll usually meet someone.
Right.
The first time, not necessarily the second time I go.
Right.
But yeah, I usually do meet the clients.
That's interesting. As far as the being part of the support team, and I this is kind of an interesting concept that you have your own business, you're independent, you know, you're doing your own production, you're an independent entity, right? But when you get into these install situations and these interact with the client at their home situations, to what extent do you think, and maybe you need to answer this from more of a philosophical perspective as well as an emotional one, to what extent do you become another sort of staff member or part of the support team for these high net worth individuals?
Really, the way that it turns out when I'm in people's houses is that I'm there as a support for the art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, very clearly, I'm being hired as an expert to be the caretaker while it's in my possession of something that they've put a lot of money into.
Right, right.
So, so I kind of feel like I get a lot of... I get more respect than other people that I see working in the places. You know, it's like I'm there as a representative for the safety of a large investment.
Yeah.
So from that angle, you know, I'm just always focused on the art.
Right.
You know, and again, I do get treated pretty well. But yeah, I'm definitely in there as the help. The really funny thing about it is the only time I ever feel kind of weird about it is when I get the shakedown from the guys in the freight elevator. Those guys are the most protective, and they are the toughest people in the buildings in Manhattan. Way more than the owners.
Interesting.
You know, they, you know, you show up as an expert, and you know, you might as well come in there wielding hammers, saying you're gonna smash all the windows in the building.
Right.
You know, that's how they treat everybody. So that actually does get under my skin a little bit, but it's never inside the apartments.
Right.
It's always the super or the building staff.
Right. So are any of your clients in that famous building on Park that houses a number of, controversial conservative types? You know the one I'm talking about? I can't remember the address. It's like 715 Park or something like that.
You know what? I'm not sure. I don't think so. I don't think I've ever been in there. I do go to a lot of places, but I don't think I've been in there.
Okay.
A lot of really beautiful places on Central Park West. A lot of people on. I've had a couple of clients on Park Avenue. A lot of them are on side streets. So many of my clients are on the Upper East Side between, I don't know, 65th and 80th, between Madison and Park.
Right.
Like that really beautiful neighborhood with all the townhouses.
Right.
Just south of the Met.
Right. Got it. What is your background, Clint, as far as, you know, what caste system are you from? Where'd you grow up? That kind of thing.
I grew up in Nebraska. I was born in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
My parents, my dad was born in Florida. My mom was born in Minnesota. They were, my grandparents were missionaries on my dad's side. So they were, extremely poor, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad grew up overseas in Philippines and Singapore. My aunts and uncles were all born in Africa. My mom comes from a very modest income family in central Minnesota. And then I was born in Nebraska because they went to a religious college there. They were in a religious college, and then they went to the University of Nebraska. And then I grew up in the basement of a house in Lincoln, Nebraska. And then my dad just kind of worked his way up the ladder. We were extremely poor when we were kids. But then I got to watch him kind of bootstrap, really, and just work really hard. So we moved a lot. I went to four different high schools.
Mm-hmm. Where did you wind up?
New York City.
Oh, so your dad moved to New York? His job took him?
No. It's really interesting. We just kind of kept moving. We went from Lincoln to Hastings, Nebraska, to Allentown, Pennsylvania, to Chesapeake, Virginia, to Omaha, Nebraska. I then moved to Minneapolis, then I went to New Jersey, and then I moved to New York City when I was 19. I finally had enough. I was like, if I'm going to be a gypsy, I might as well move to a gypsy town.
Right,
1996, New York City was a gypsy town.
But when you moved to New York, was the place you were moving from where your parents were, or was that just where you were?
I had moved out of my parents' house when I was 17, and that's when I moved to Minneapolis because I was going to go to the Minneapolis Institute of Art and Design for painting.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to Minneapolis, I realized that I didn't want to stay there. And I'd gone there because my mom's family's from there, so I moved in with my aunt because I was 17. And then I decided I wanted to do photography instead. So when I moved to Minneapolis, my parents moved to New Jersey. And then I decided to move back into my parents' house because I had decided to come to New York. And then I lived there for 10 or 12 months just before I could, you know, while I was doing my entrance stuff for School of Visual Arts.
Mm.
So I'd taken a summer class at School of Visual Arts and commuted. And then for my first year of School of Visual Arts, I commuted from New Jersey until I could find a place to live, come up with some money, all that kind of stuff. And
right.
Then I moved to the city.
What part of New Jersey did you commute from?
Ringwood. And it was sheer determination to get here every day from there.
How far is that?
It was an hour and a half.
Hour and
about
a half.
An hour and a half each way on the bus. So I
Ooh.
Spent like three
Ouch.
3 hours on a local bus
yeah.
every day.
Right, right,
it was
right.
Misery.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Got it, got it. And now you're a big successful business owner. How about that?
I'm trying.
Well,
I'm really trying.
Well, the part of the reason I'm interested in, and we could certainly, you know, if we wanted to, dive deeper into your growing up and all of that. But the main reason that I wanted to you to articulate that is because I wanted to see how that played into your interactions with your clients, particularly the ones in the homes that we were talking about. And I wonder if, for example, you hadn't grown up upper middle class or higher, if being in those kinds of situations might make you more uncomfortable. Because there's something about, in addition to whatever grief the supers are giving you in the freight elevators, there's something very submissive about, subservient even, about being in those situations. And even though it's all about protecting the art, you know, and being there for the art, there still is that dynamic. And I would just hazard finally that, based on talking to you and your disposition, that you see it very practically as all part of the job and you don't take it personally.
I don't. And, you know, I think, and maybe this is naive, but I kind of think most people are fairly simple. You know, like, I think a lot of, you know, when coming to any conversation with someone else, right, there's a ton of baggage on either side, no matter who it is,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has their preconceived notions about everyone else, even if you've never met them before.
I mean,
you know, appearance, first looks, and then whatever you're afraid of is projected onto someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, it greatly influences the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and I just really try to just be present and informative, right? And nice.
Right.
And I kind of feel like, you know, again, with, you know, going into a very nice apartment with a person who has way more money than I'll ever have in my life, I don't find those communication situations intimidating anymore. And I think just starting from that perspective kind of also disarms the client.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because I also think there is sort of like this, you know, when people go into these places that are not on that socioeconomic, from that status, I kind of feel like they bring as much weirdness as they think the client is, right?
Mm, mm-hmm.
And what you mean is this, you know, and then you're mentioning sort of this, like, subservient sort of situation. I kind of feel like the clients, they may even feel that that's a little weird. You know what I mean? Like, if there's this sort of, yes, man type of approach. I think sometimes that might even be kind of annoying.
Sure.
You know, like what I've figured out over the years is that, again, I, at least from my perspective, you know, I'm in these clients' homes because they want an expert, right?
Right.
So it's like, if you don't go into these places with an opinion, it's going to be really difficult.
Right.
Right? Because they need help. You're actually there because they don't know how to do what you're doing.
Right.
And you could, you know, you could be installing a toilet or laying a floor.
Yeah.
You know, that it doesn't really matter. As long as you go in there and you know exactly what you're doing, I think you'll get a lot of respect. And I don't know if you necessarily have to play a role other than just know what you're doing, right? It's right. Like, you know, a lot of these clients are they're not wealthy for no reason. You know, a lot of these people have worked very hard in their lives. There's a lot of people, you know, who have, you know, started businesses or changed industry themselves. It's not, you know, it's not always like this, like, you know, what people would think, this like sort of lazy old money kind of situation.
Right.
I don't ever see that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so it's, I don't know. Usually I find that as long as you, you know, bring your A game and you're fairly normal and communicate in a professional way, I don't feel like I have to play that kind of role.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know, and am I super relaxed? You know, do I put a drink on a table? I don't do anything like that. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like you're definitely in somebody else's house, but I don't do any. You know, the stuff that I wouldn't do in their house, I wouldn't do in your house if I came to your house either. You know what I mean? I would still be, like, really respectful of your stuff.
Right, okay. Yeah. I think the most important word that you used earlier is when you said, I'm not intimidated going into these places anymore. Because, I think that's really the important part of the story is that, like with me, you know, because I've had a limited number of experiences in these types of situations, I probably have, if not necessarily felt intimidated, just felt this sort of weird vibe, you know, this kind of formal, you know, okay, what do we do? What's the etiquette now vibe kind of
right.
thing. You know, I think you've worked through that. You've been in the, I don't know if you've been doing it the whole 10 years you've been in business, but obviously a lot more than half. And so you've done it enough times where it's like, okay, I know what the ritual is, you know, I'm just going to do my job and that's going to be it.
Yeah. Well, and also the other thing that, that is really involved in that is so much of the stuff that happens outside of their apartment, that happens actually at Downing Frames. Because, of course, in the past 10 years of owning this business, I also have learned so much more than I ever thought I would. You know, so I have much more developed answers for people. Mm. You know, I mean, they can, you know, 5 years ago, if I were to be asked like a fairly technical question about something, if I didn't know the answer, then I would have kind of felt, you know, like inadequate, right? Because you want to give them the best answer possible. Because of course you want to be a professional. You want them to use your services again. So it's also kind of like this hidden sales opportunity, right? Like you're in there presenting yourself as a business owner and somebody that they could use again. So you really do want to be on your A game. And I feel like with just so much more experience in general, that, you know, I'm just bringing so much more to these situations than I was before.
Right. And unlike with the clients, particularly the collector clients, that is, where you're in their homes figuring out problems, with the artists, I take it the majority of that work is done at Downing and not in their studios having conversations about figuring things out.
I have never been in a client's home with an artist.
No, I'm sorry. What I meant was you being at an artist studio, just not with the client, just with yourself.
A lot of the times it's done at my shop. I do try to get out of here, but we're just so busy all the time. The next phase of my business is going to be more of having a much more developed middle management staff so I can do that, because it's so it's so much better for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's better for the artist. Like, it's really nice for me to be able to be in artist spaces, right? I can get having a feel for them as creators and as people really does inform me about how I can do my job for them. So when I do have the luxury of going to artist studios, I really enjoy it. I mean, if it were up to me, I'd do most of my work there.
That was my point. It was to sort of distinguish the dynamic of being at the client's home versus being at the artist studio.
Yeah, it's very different. It's very, very different. In the client's home, you know, you're really just there to, like, for me, most of the time it's about an install. right? And or some sort of install kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
There's never sort of a design collaboration. That's very rare for me to do in a client's house.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, with the artists at the artist studios, there's a lot more design, and it's a kind of a possibility-focused kind of conversation.
Right. So I was thinking, as far as you mentioned the expression skill set, and it's not my favorite expression, but as far as the range of things that you apply to the work that you do, it sounds like in addition to, obviously, carpentry, you know, which is sort of one very base level word to describe that what goes into framing. There's also design, obviously, but even engineering, right, to a certain extent. And correct me if I'm wrong. And if that's the case, how have you been able to learn those more complicated things? Is it simply self-taught, or how does that work?
I have a lot of very talented friends outside of here,
mm-hmm.
which really helps me out.
Right.
I have, a lot of preparators at galleries. I guess more in specifically, like some of the engineering stuff is like a lot of load-bearing
right.
questions. Like if we're dealing with really heavy stuff, I have to really design for hanging or support. Any other kind of advice, I mean, I have like an amazing pool of friends, and then also the artists that we work with. You know, a lot of the artists that I have, different mediums. You know, photography, painting, sculpture. So or CNC work, for example. You know,
right.
I needed like a more specific type of laser cutter.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent an email to one of the artists that I know that does a laser cutter, and you know, get the conversation started there. A lot of the times we have to do custom metal fabrication for different projects.
Mm.
It's just, and now after 10 years, you just, you know, it's slow to add your extensions outside of your business. But now I do have a lot of really trusted advisors and fabricators that I know now. And then some of the stuff is trial and error. You know, of course, look it up online like everyone else.
Right.
Typically, I don't get a lot of answers there, but I at least
that's reassuring.
You know, but sometimes you see something that like sparks an idea,
you know,
or puts you in a different direction.
Right.
You know, now that I'm in a very, you know, kind of in a place now that when I go online, you know, your expertise is just, there's so much weekend warrior stuff online.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's less helpful these days, but
yeah.
But yeah, lots of different stuff. And then of course, what's been really nice, in the last year
mm-hmm.
is that we've gotten to a much higher level of buying, right? So we purchase so much product here that the manufacturers or these businesses recognize Downing Frames.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been approached by a lot of big suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of opened the door for me to just realize you can just call the company, you know, like, or companies in general. I think for some reason, I just missed that part.
Right.
You know, like
right.
if I want to hang something really heavy or if I need some sort of design question, you know, like any sort of design, you just kind of think of what industry is that and who can I call and ask.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of amazing what you'll get if you just call and ask people.
Sure. So Clint, do you collect yourself?
I do.
What do you collect?
Every once in a while I'll do trades. I really started to get focused on that.
Sure.
For many different reasons. But I do, and I'm starting to really enjoy that. I now could actually hang my apartment twice with the amount of artwork I have.
Nice.
So I store art now,
what,
which I never thought would happen to me.
What are some of your favorite pieces, if you could share?
I have like I did a trade with a gallery for a Christopher Wolf poster from a show that he did in Greece in 1992, which is kind of fun. It's just a text poster, which just very frankly explains, if you can't take a joke, you can get the fuck out of my house. I have that in my living room.
Okay.
I have two pieces from Gentleman's Game. They're a collaborative artist duo, Brandon Friend and Jason Douglas Griffin. They do amazing work. I have two of their pieces. I have a really nice Swoon piece that I like. It's one of the subway window pieces from the, I think it's late, or maybe 2007. I have a Richard Barnes photograph of the Unabomber's cabin. He reached out to the defense team when they took his house to California. So he got exclusive access to this warehouse with Ted Kaczynski's home in it.
Right. They're
beautiful pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I have Smith's photograph that she gave me when I worked at Baobab. Andrea Serrano gave me a piece. I work with David LaChapelle to all of his framing. He gave me a really amazing nativity scene 2 years ago for Christmas, which is fantastic.
Well, that's an example of some gratitude from a client, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get any better than having them giving you a piece.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's amazing to get a piece from David and have him put a personal message about our work on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's awesome.
Right. But the other trades that you've done generally are, you do work for the artist and then the artist gives you a piece, right?
Yeah. And I've only done that a couple of times, and I've done that in very specific situations,
mm-hmm.
you know, like sometimes, and this actually goes back to what you were saying before, where if they pick some sort of design that's a little more expensive than they can afford, you know, I do try to help people. You know, it's not like, you know, if you mm-hmm. can't afford it, don't call me.
Right.
And I'll definitely,
right.
you know, I'll definitely try to help. So in some cases, I'll just ask for a trade.
Right.
You know, that's where most of the trades have come from, is if somebody wanted something that was past their means.
Yeah.
I'll try to work something out.
Yeah. Well, Clint, when my budget reaches the next level, I'm giving you a call. So be prepared.
Hey, we could work something out now. I'm sure we could.
Okay, that sounds like a plan. Well, it's been great talking to Clint. I think we went some interesting places after all. So thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And great. We're out. Excellent. Thanks, Clint.
Thank you so much again to Clint. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation and are curious to find out more about what he does and maybe how you can become a client. Before we get to the chat about Louise Lawler in just a moment, I wanted to take a moment to remind you again about submitting your suggestions for the 200th episode. And, of course, remind you that this is a listener-supported show. There is no advertising on this show, and that means the only financial support is from you, the listener. It has been some time since the funds have come in from you guys, so wanted to impress upon you how much it makes me happy, how much it helps the show keep going, and you can do that a couple of ways. One is Patreon. You can become a regular donator monthly. That can be for as little as a dollar a month, although if you do start at $3 a month, you will be primed for those special bonus episodes, three of them now, more to come. You can donate one time via PayPal for as little as $25. Certainly more would be appreciated, but whatever you can afford would also be appreciated. And again, your financial support really does keep the show going. We may be moving down to once every other week. So maybe you can change that with your donations. Of course, you can also support the show non-financially by following the show on social media at Artist Podcast, also on Facebook. You can leave a great review on iTunes to help more people find the show. You can recommend me, the host, to other podcasts that where I, you think I might be a good fit. If I go on them, other people will find out about the show as well, and we'll all be so much happier, more satisfied, more fulfilled. So I read about Louise Lawler. I started to say I've not talked to her personally, although if you do know her, I would be very grateful if you would put us in touch. She seems like the kind of person who would not do a podcast because she keeps a very low profile, as it turns out, from which I did not know in reading this review of her retrospective by my favorite art writer, Peter Sheldahl in The New Yorker, from a couple weeks ago. It's one of those reviews, and I'm sure you read them, where you go, I really want to go see that show. And unfortunately, I'm on the West Coast. I don't know if I will be coming to New York before July 30th of 2017. It's pretty unlikely. So I'm asking you, the New York listeners, to go check it out on my behalf and let me know what you think, okay? I've always appreciated Louise Lawler's work on a very small scale because I haven't seen much of it in quite a while. I haven't lived in New York in a while. And she has not shown, other than maybe a spare piece here and there in Los Angeles. So wanted to read you a particularly intriguing section of this review. And again, as you're listening to this, if you do know her or know somebody who knows her, put the word out. She needs to be reminded that I am not the media, and that this is not going to put her in the spotlight if she were to come on here. So all that said, he writes about three quarters of the way into the piece about her recent work. Her recent work lampoons the pressure on artists to produce big scale works to satisfy a trend in galleries and museums toward ever pompously larger exhibition spaces. It consists of photographs or tracings of them that she has made of artworks installed in museums. Sculptures by Jeff Koons and Donald Judd, paintings by Lucio Fontana and Frank Stella. The pictures are enlarged and distorted, scrunched or elongated to fit the dimensions of vast walls. In one of them, shot from floor level in a room displaying minimalist works by Judd, Stella, and Saul LeWitt, the blur of someone's striding leg intrudes evidence of real time on putatively timeless art. The effect of the mural-making distortions is spectacularly clumsy, cranking up a pitch of arbitrariness to something like a shriek. So that definitely whetted my appetite. I hope it wet yours, especially if you're in New York and you can go see this. Do go see it. And let us know what you think. If you have some really interesting things to say, maybe we'll even have a conversation about it on a recording. And we'll make it part of a future episode. So I think that's all for today. Perhaps I will talk to you next week, perhaps the week after. But in any case, I thank you very much for listening to the show. I welcome your feedback of any kind. And I thank you for listening to the show. I will talk to you soon. Ciao for now.